very quickly, my name is Jay Tucker. I run a center right across the 405 at the business school that's focused on the entertainment industry. Super excited to be here with, as you've already heard, a number of experts in the space so that we can talk about cognitive intelligence, artificial intelligence. We'll talk a little bit, hopefully, about cybernetic intelligence and so on. I want to give Eve a chance to complete one of the many threads that you introduced in that kind of cavalcade of whimsy there. So you're looking at all of this data, and obviously you're giving structure and building models around some of this stuff to get it to make sense. My question for you, the first question, and I'm going to start going down the line for everybody else as well, but my question for you to kick this off is, how much of this is actionable? So, for example, when you talk about the insights around storytelling itself, knowing how relationship-driven Hollywood is on the creative side, you know, is that an insight that you can actually leverage and, you know, push the industry forward and potentially generate more revenue and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. Thank you. It's obviously an issue, right? So as we all know, organizations are the enemy of everything. Unfortunately, we have advanced tremendously in our society and our technology, and we have to deal with organizations and organizational models that were built in the 19th century. So really, the new frontier of innovation is really innovation in organizations. And to that point, it is and it isn't, right? So it is because, fortunately or unfortunately for the industry, decisions have been made with the wrong models and not enough data for a very long time. And so it's still a very, very inefficient process. So as I was mentioning, and the numbers are staggering, right? So if you can make a $5 billion marketing budget 10% perform 10% better, that's $500 million. That's a lot of money. You're right in there's a lot of resistance, cultural resistance to the stuff that we're doing. In the creative community, actually, more the studios love it. I mean, that's what they've been looking for a while. But at a minimum, what I'm trying to build is, when I tell people, it's not really solutions, it's language, a grammar. Right? If we can find the story graphics study that we're doing, we got a lot of pushback from writers saying, hey, you're trying to build machines to do my job. No, we're building a language, a common language for you and the studios to talk. This is a language of performance that suddenly it's a common language between the creative community and the studio community. So we're really trying to create at this point processes and sort of new grammars for the business.
That's great. That's great. Amber, I'm going to jump to you at that moment specifically because I am curious. You talked a lot about technology, discovery, recommendations, etc. You held back from saying that all the curation, et cetera, is going to be done solely by machines. And I'm hearing Eve say something complimentary, which is essentially when we talk about how we use these insights, that there's got to be some combination. We don't expect the artificial intelligence to do it all. I mean, what do you think about this? How would you respond?
I hate the idea, or phrase rather, artificial intelligence, because it implies that, like, well, what is intelligence? And then it's artificial. Like, it's like saying jumbo shrimp. Like, this thing has come up in like the 60s, it's come up in the 80s. It's like a whole new buzzword thing, right? But really, there's automation, which we've seen since the Industrial Revolution, which has freed up some things and really annoyed other people and displaced other people. And then we've seen there's machine learning, which is really interesting, right? There's algorithms, like there's all these pieces, and even use the term like just kind of like makes a blanket statement that gives us expectations about some perfection in technology that we know we're building the technology and we're not perfect and we're never going to get it perfect or right. And the more we put in, the more it's going to become more organic. There's this sociologist Emil Durkheim that said, as societies progress, they go from more mechanical to more organic, where, for instance, like our systems and infrastructures, like they often crash. Like, but a human doesn't die because they have a cold. There are antibodies, and it's okay because all of us have some sort of weird virus right now. That's like, and we're used to it, right? And so the same thing, like, yeah, well, some of us have partially a cold or something like that, but we're not dying. Some of us kind of feel bad or like our backs ache because we've been sitting on airplanes for too long, right? But that's not going to destroy our systems. And so I think more about if we're going to have machine intelligence, whatever intelligence is, it's going to be a lot more like naturally, organically informed, because that's kind of how nature does it. Like computational biology and stuff is much more interesting to me than saying we're going to make an artificial system that's perfect. Like, it's a lot of people who are like, let's just change everything and put it on the blockchain and then we'll just magically have perfected everything. There's no magic perfect moment. You can't make something perfect if you're starting with humans. Like, we're not perfect. So the minute we embrace those things and we say we'll make something granular that's kind of a mess and we'll get better at it over time and we'll evolve it over time and work with the limitations of those systems and understand that we're not perfect, then maybe we can get somewhere interesting in a couple years. But I'm sorry, I get so mad about like this AI stuff. but it's important to not think about, you know, there's a solution point where everything's solved. Like, that's never going to happen. But if we embrace it and we say, that's okay, we can get there. And some of these things are better at being automated or algorithmicized. And we still remember that, like, when you go to a restaurant, you don't want a computer to tell you what wine to drink. You have a sommelier who has really good taste buds, right, who's developed this over time. And even then, like, do you really want some robotic machine to tell you that you want, like, that you want to drink this sort of thing? Like, there are things that we need to rely on people for, and we can't exist without technology, and technology can't exist without us. Our choice in purchasing it allows it to reproduce. So we, you know, we're symbiotic with it since the beginning of time. But saying something like artificial intelligence, like it would stand outside of ourselves, is complete BS, because we still have to program it. And so it's inherently really human, and it's not artificial at all.
Right. By the way, I completely agree. Anybody who's saying that they want to build an AI that's perfect doesn't know what they're talking about, right? But what AI can do, and very, very quickly, because I don't want to monopolize the conversation, but AI can do something, or computers can do something that humans... humans can do things better than computers, and computers can do some things better than human, right? And really, you have to, and all the stuff that we're building really has a mix of the two, right? And in fact, if you build an AI system, having humans to be able to train it is accelerates the learning curve enormously. What humans can't process billions of data points. So something that I'm personally really interested in that I think we can agree on is, the entirety of human knowledge was created by looking at the interaction between 4 or 5 or 6 variables. Well, what happens if we're trying to approach extremely complex problems? What happens when we throw 1 million variables at understanding cancer? What happens when we throw 1 million variables at understanding poverty or development? That's the kind of AI that I want to see. That's the kind of system. That's a revolution in human knowledge. That is an augmentation of our capability to understand our universe in its entirety and its complexity.
Love that. And that's a perfect segue, because Josh, the question I was going to ask you was, what do these technologies mean to the industry? I mean, in a practical way, you know, what define the problem space for us.
I'm not going to use the two-letter word that gets upset, so I'll stay away from the
issues. Yeah. No A words.
I want Amber to relax. I think we all do and enjoy this. So no two words. It's a great question. And I think what we're trying to do is use smart machines, use the machine learning, to actually help create metadata quicker, rather than have to apply bodies and bodies and bodies and buildings and buildings and buildings. So use all of the 4 big cloud providers they have. There's a lot of academic institutes that have created these machine learning models that, as the Amazon guy is going to say later, it can be a few lines of code just to be able to put billions of photos up into the cloud, and it will tell you what's in that photo, who's in that photo, the emotion of the people in the photo. So we're trying to go after 2 areas in the M&E space. One's around compliance. So we think there's a lot of time spent in compliance, and the amount of content that's getting created and the amount of countries it's got to go for all the different platforms, it won't work if you have to keep throwing the amount of bodies at it for localization, compliance, all of these checks. It's just economically it won't make sense. So we're trying to use machine learning to detect things like nudity, swear words, partial swear words, smoking. Are they actually showing a belly button for a content that's going to India? So compliance is one, and the other one is search and recommendation. There's a lot of metadata about the technical asset, which is what the gentleman from Amazon was talking about, and there's a lot of title-based metadata coming out of things like IDA, but what's missing is the metadata about what's inside the content. Some studios have been at this for a while. They've got good metadata. Others might be building it in-house or just deciding to wait, but we need more metadata, and that's how we're using. So automation, really, with machine learning, and I never said the 2 letters.
So Philip, I see you nodding your head. I think you've got a couple of practical use cases as well,
Yeah, yeah, exactly. My goal is to use these smart machines to better get metadata that then we can use perhaps other smart machines to take the boring out of post, which has been my slogan for a very long time. Most of post-production is routine, boring, slow, and not very creative. You know, if
which is why it's perfect for me.
Well, if we're trying to create a perfect movie, why isn't the script as shot the perfect movie? Why do we spend a day to take 45 seconds out of the movie in post-production if the script was the perfect movie? So if we have a perfectly written script from some sort of machine, it's still not going to be the finished script that is going to be delivered. So, yes, we get this better acquisition of metadata, which gives us more time to spend on being creative, doing the things that the humans do really, really well, finding that moment of insight that connects this dot with this dot and creates something that otherwise wouldn't be magic. You know, you would not think that Hanky Panky and 16 going on 17 intercut very well, but when the same performer's doing it in consecutive days, they do. I don't expect a machine to find that connection any time in my lifetime. Maybe in the future, maybe not. However, we can get more time for the creative spark that the human does, and particularly with non-scripted, we can have the opportunity to explore more of stories. If we can have a machine extract the metadata and then say, well, I'd like to explore putting this keyword and this keyword together and see what sort of story structure or string out comes out of that to give some inspiration, or try this keyword with that keyword. As I said in my earlier introduction, we have spare processor cycles. We have the metadata. We have the algorithms to allow us to start to explore it. Then why shouldn't we use that to free us to do the things that we do really well? I really like the concept of Steve Jobs' bicycle of the mind, which he said, you know, human is not a very fast creature, but a human on a bike is faster than most creatures.
Love it. So, MJ, we've talked about compliance, post-production. Can you talk a little bit about how we can use some of these technologies to affect the audience's experience, whether that's discovery or...
Yeah, I'd like to come back to my sure. panelist partners in crime here on definitely automation, machine learning, with the curation. I know at TiVo it's both, and we've had disasters where we've tried to build a lot of automation. I can remember many, many years ago doing that. And Amber, you pointed out earlier when you just end up by getting really good at repeating the same thing and it gets boring. Mm-hmm. So you need to constantly interject randomness or surprises, and sometimes a mistake, an accident by a human editor produces new insight, new data, or new social trend, or new data elements. So very organic, very accidental. It's great. So take the best of that, best of both. And then to your kind of question for discovery and things like that and recommendations, earlier it's been mentioned in the sessions, the connection. So machine learning, one of the great, great things we're seeing now is the ability to connect both inside content. I know at TiVo we're doing that with several of the studios in their back catalogs and their current ones, and surface those associations and those weights. And then one thing I do want to build on, there's a comment about what's popular, what's not, and we'll pick on the belly button comment about ratings, and that's a great example. The same title has different cultural meanings to different people, humans around this planet. And we might all have a shared cultural range about a title, about a scene, about a setting, about many of the attributes even from stories. There were some cases tremendously different in some of the other cultures. I spent a lot of time in Asia, and there's some very fundamental difference that are ahas. So my point is machine models are great at surfacing maybe multiple models and pulling those back as insights, so that when you deliver them and distribute out there, there's additional metadata that now may be focused and targeted to that market, which may actually, in some cases, those associations not apply, say, to the European or the American markets.
Let me just very quickly riff off that. So the study that we did looking at stories and character mechanics and box office returns, we split it down by countries. But a few, not all of them, but you know, a few markets, we were surprised to see there's very little variance in the results. And I think it has to do with the fact that at the end of the day, And we've actually noticed that, right? At the end of the day, the reason Hollywood is so powerful and Hollywood movies are so popular all around the world is that they can tap into a non-cultural, purely cognitive aspect of how we process the reality around us. And that's what I'm really interested in. In fact, if you look at the structure of narrative, the ideal structure of narrative per the Dramatica taxonomy and the research that we've done around what's popular, it is very, very similar to how our episodic memory works. There's a whole domain of neuroscience called narrative intelligence, looking at episodic memory. And my hunch, and I don't know for sure, but my hunch is that there is something about the way Hollywood tells stories that speaks to humans overall. And of course, there are tremendous differences between cultures and individually and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, that algorithmic structure, that cognitive structure of stories, is really very, very similar for all humans.
MJ, I totally resonate with your point about the title. I'm kind of a comic book nerd, and I noticed that the upcoming X-Men title is going to be Supernova, which I think is going to have interesting implications in Latin America, right? Like, so the super doesn't go. Look at you. You're processing that, right? Yes. Like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay, so looking at what artificial intelligence can do in that space, when we think about the use of language or narrative structure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, do you guys envision a time when a film, a TV series, a song, or a collection of songs will be created entirely by machines?
I'm challenged, and I sent a question out to, and I'll put out to the audience. There's a humongous rights issue with that. So let's say we take a machine model and we scan 10,000 songs. Let's pick on that, the IBM announcement last year. So we scan 10,000 creative works, and a machine algorithm built by humans creates a brand new work. Is that a derivative work? Do they have rights? Does the machine have rights? Does the programmer have rights? Do the components that went into making that melody, the lyrics, the higher weights association for whatever genre, for whatever culture, whatever's trending right now, do they all participate in the ownership of that? Well, humongous questions around. So I say the industry needs to sort a lot of this out, because a machine models, if it's a supervised trained model, it's using creative works as its basis. And if we all follow kind of rights and so forth, there's a very touchy subject going on around that.
Well, I want to answer your question with another question, which is, how is it different from the way humans learn to play music and write music and perform music now, right? I mean, you've got, if you're a human learning to play music, you're studying the rules, the knowledge, the history, the catalog that's available to you. I mean, is it different?
And or just outright covering another artist's song, and that's perfectly okay, and you pay that other artist.
Well, but the question is it different when it's a machine doing it?
Sometimes. I mean, the primordial case on this was Girl Talk. The musician just sampled like 600 type of music and then said, well, I've sampled all of this, and then got in big trouble, and then Lawrence Lessig was like, okay, well, I'll represent you. Right, and I don't know how it all went, but there's now a documentary about it. But I think looking at these artist spaces where like an artist says, well, I'm just going to grab this and make this film, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this project and make this algorithmic poetry and things like that, how that gets legislated will be fun to watch. And I'm going to watch the art edges to see where it starts, to see where they play at those edges. And then maybe in the end, it's like, if you get a weird judge, then you can set back the legislation by 5 years. You don't know what's going to happen, you know? And sometimes it takes a while to become standardized. But I think as few spaces you can watch is like artists just playing with these algorithms and see what happens. And there was that one case with Girl Talk, but I don't know if anybody in this room knows what happened to that or whether it was considered fair use to sample 600 songs.
This is interesting, because I think at the end of the day, the studio will get the right. And I think this is why I'm so adamant about having studios start to experiment right now and learn right now about AI, because it will be a completely mixed machine and human model, but whoever, you know, the IP will still be with the studio, and you can't compete if you're using the same tools as everybody else. Everybody has to be in their own tools. I was a massive Prince fan, and when Prince died, I was heartbroken, and as an engineer, I created an AI to make new Prince music. We trained all of the, you know, on, it was terrible. It was absolutely awful, just awful. Because of the complexity of Prince music, right? If you had taken other types of music, it would have done a lot better. But it really has anything to do with how able a machine is to represent complexity. For a lot of things, it's performing horribly.
Yeah, I think there was a question in the audience.
Yeah, I'm going to take questions in a little bit. Josh, did you want to?
Something that's interesting is there's a lot of creative talk about AI, and I wonder, I mean, a lot of what you're doing in the project is around the creative and the storytelling and the content. I don't think there's enough focus on the distribution and the economics of that and how the machine learning can help reduce the costs, because that's where there seems to be a bottleneck, whether it's in localization, IMF packaging, compliance. Yeah. I mean, it's great to talk about the movie maker and the DP and how they're doing all this stuff. There's enough money in making movies, I think. The problem is, how do we get it out? So I think the machine learning on distribution, how it's going to help facilities and services, I think there probably needs to be more effort around that versus the story making and the creative side as well.
Second that, probably the number one thing with TiVo is actually assisting with both machine and curation, honestly, for all of the different countries, distribution. Huge challenge, and just be clear, that's automation, you know, full up. Yep. Yes, it's using a lot of machine learning. There's reasons for that, but it's automation.
It's something he said was the studios need to start. I think the big cloud providers have made this very easy to actually get going. You can sit and procrastinate for a year, 2 years. You can have a five-year R&D project, and you're going to be in a horrible spot 5 years later if you're not really using it. So I think the big providers, the academic institutes, the things you're doing, you might as well start now, because the pace that it's going, even outside of M&E, if you wait, you'd be stupid to wait. You might as well try this now. The other thing is cost. People think these are multi-million-dollar solutions to use machine learning. If you go to any of these cloud platforms and upload 10,000 photos, you'd be surprised at what it's actually going to cost you. It isn't actually that much to use the models that are already out there. Where it does get a bit costly is to build these custom models that you've all talked about. But if there's enough gain there and you want to train a model on what smoking looks like or someone snorting cocaine or rolling a cigarette, these are all things that humans have to identify. Even that isn't too crazy on the pricing to train a model if you already have the IP, the photos and the images that you can upload. So.
And time is a critical factor because if you're dealing with systems that train in the model, I know Netflix is here in the house. Netflix is far ahead and may never be able. Nobody may be able to catch up with them because they have, I don't know, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years of training and testing their models. If you build a Netflix system today and you start training it today, they still have 5 years ahead of you of training, right? So that time is a critical factor. That's all I want to say.
And you don't have to go into complex machine learning models and creating your own. The cognitive services that are available from a number of providers are incredibly inexpensive. I think, you know, IBM Watson is 2 cents a minute for transcription, speech to text. This is compared with 50 or a cents or a dollar or $2 current industry standards. That's a huge reduction in cost and making something much more accessible. You will transcribe a whole lot more material when it's 2 cents a minute than you will transcribe at $2 a minute, simply because it's 100 times cheaper.
Yeah. So questions?
Questions from the audience? Oh, here we go. One brave soul, Eric Deal from Sony.
No, I'm not going to take that one. He's way too smart for me. You guys take
it. I agree on everything you are saying, but sometimes we may be surprised, because I have the feeling that when I hear a lot about what you say about smart machines and so on, that it's something which is more or less dumb and is repeating that, and there is no possibility of having some surprise. And I remind everybody that AlphaGo, the competition, in the third game, the machine win by playing one coup that no expert understood, no reasonable Go player would ever done this movement. And when they analyzed that afterward, it was something which was genius, if we can say genius, but it won the party. It was that, but no reasonable good Go player would have played that. Because as was said by Yves, the machine are able to analyze far more information than us. So maybe we can find also new things, and we may have some serendipity coming just by the machine itself. Not in all cases, but we may have some surprise. But yes, the human is most important. I agree with you.
But this is called there's a Medium blog post called Move 37, and I really highly encourage you guys to go read it. It's amazing, right? And what Eric says is really important is like AlphaGo was able to access a mathematical reality that we couldn't access as humans, right? And this is really what this is the promise of augmentation. Guys, we know nothing. We know zero about who we are and the universe that we live in. We know zero, and AlphaGo was able to access a level of this mathematical reality that we live in that we don't know anything about that we couldn't access. And that really, for me, is the most interesting aspect of AI, is being able to finally understand who we are and why we're here and the universe that we live in.
You know, I just wanted to build on, and that's an example of using that as input into, again, a human that's going to create that final work, whatever it is. It's an insight and a tool for a human to do that creative thingy. And we all know lots of tools have been amazing over the last few thousand years as humans. A tool.
Thanks for bringing up Go. That's important, because before that it was just like, AI plays chess. And then it was like, can AI play Go? The college I went to, there was a guy who was like training computers to play Go. And then when I was in school, it was like, no, it's never going to happen. And then it happened. It's like, okay, the universe is now like a more open space for these things. So
exactly.
Yeah, good point.
And by the way, the AlphaGo was trained to play on a 19 by 19 board. If it had played on a triangular board, on an 18 by 18 board, it would have failed. It would have needed to be completely reprogrammed. So humans are, again, able to laterally apply their learning and their domain to other areas and that's one of the big problems of machine learning, is that the domain of application is extremely narrow and fails really, really easily. Yes. Where humans have the ability to reason, remember, the running with a bucket of nails. Machines can't do that, right?
All right, I think we're out of time. Yeah. Jay, great panel. Thank you so much to Jay.
Thanks,
thank
everybody.
You to the panelists.